want to start to become the type of person that thinks more about proxy counter arguments to, not proxy, that's not the right word, but counter arguments to a lot of the common complaints of the world or of happenings that are all based in fear. Things like climate change and AI and war and all of the happenings in the world, structures, systems, and political ideologies, all these things. And I want to be the person, not collectively, but for myself, I want to be a person that makes sure that I don't diminish my optimism and my light and my willingness to look at all sides, whereas it feels very easy to take the default fear-based stance on something and not throttle myself because it's not popular to be positive right now. And positive is often dismissed. Positive can be seen as like, oh, you're just being toxically positive. You're just coming up with the bright side of things. You're just trying to see things as like in rose-colored glasses. It's not really like that. You know, to be realistic is to be dark and gritty and to see the edges and to see the end of everything. Everything leads to heat death. To that I call bullshit. And it's funny because it's sort of, there's an anger that activates through me to get to the other side of seeing the optimism. For me, I think the anger comes from not taking the extra step. That there's very much a decision to stay in the fear response. To stay in repeating the same ideas over and over again around like, the world is ending. Everything's coming to a head. Everything's going to collapse and fall apart. And to that I say, I understand where that comes from. I understand the concerns. And I understand the fear. I feel the fear. And there's a scope of reality and existence, not only the human sphere of things, but the animal kingdom, our environment, the scale and scope of the universe and all of its happenings, that is very difficult to comprehend. For example, much of the time when we have complaints about people and we say like, this person is the same kind of person that says this, we're usually talking about two different people that we've kind of overly patterned or categorized in our imagination as being the same person, but it's not the same person. And so we say like the same people that are saying that abortion should be illegal is the same person that is saying that we should love everyone. And that may or may not be true. But usually we have these like few experiences where we meet or come across a few people, and then we pattern and we expand that to as many people as we can to make us feel like we know what's going on, to make us feel comfortable, to make us feel safe. Because even if we can identify the enemies and we can identify the fear and we can identify the direction to where things are going, then we can feel some sense of control and we can feel some sense of direction. Even if that direction is into the bottom of a volcano. To that, I say the challenge now is how to go into the unknown when the unknown may be light. You know, we always talk about the unknown being about going into the darkness, right? It's like the dark alley or the dark closet or the monsters under the bed. There's always like an unknownness when it comes to darkness. But what about the unknownness when it comes to light? Like, the unknownness when it comes to the inside of a star. I mean, we know the molecules and we have a general sense of the idea of, you might just get the raspy version of me today. The general sense of what's in there. But if the universe was just pure light, it would be the same kind of idea. We would just reverse it. We would say, like, the light is unknown, you know. When there's pure light and everything is covered, like, you can't see anything. The same way that in darkness, when darkness fully covers everything, you can't see anything, right? It's really the contrast of light and dark that creates visibility. It's not pure light and it's not pure darkness. Funny enough, we were watching Star Wars recently, and I've been, for some reason, going through the prequel movies, and I just kind of want to watch them in order again, with the kids in particular, because I think there's some interesting messages in those stories, especially those prequels, with the idea of light and dark and, you know, the Jedi and the Sith, and some interesting sort of back and forths around, you know, due process and trials and balance of the Force. You know, Anakin was supposed to be the set balance to the Force, and you know, he brought darkness, which may have been the balance that was required. And when we think about balance, we always think about, you know, the light needs to win. When balance is really, it's balance. It's a little bit of everything, right? And right now, it does feel like the imbalance, at least with humans, and some of the humans I'm surrounded by, is the awareness of lightness, of potential, of possibilities, and the accuracy of those possibilities. When we have a limited perspective, it's really easy to take a probability to its worst potential. Because all we have is this sort of isolated, focused experience. If this is all we know, then this is all it's going to become. And so expanding our territory, expanding our awareness is vital, and it's important. One of the ways that we can do that, one of the ways that is super important today to be able to do, even if we can't afford to have those experiences, one of the great benefits of today's world is that even though we blame media, social media, all sorts of things, video games for problems, these are ways that we can have proxy experiences to expand our awareness and our worldview. I was just watching a clip about emperor penguins that when we've never seen before what they do when they are growing up and they have their first jump off of a cliff. In 2009, I think they were observed walking towards this cliff edge. But because we didn't have drone technology or we didn't have ways to easily witness this, drone technology creates this smaller package that makes less noise that will not startle the animals. Now we can now witness this. And I think it was January of this year, 2024, that one of the National Geographic explorers was able to take a drone and watch this play out. And watching this play out is this gorgeous scenario of these penguins, these young penguins gathering together on a cliff edge, and the first few of them jump off, and it's like 40 to 50 feet. And we've not witnessed this. We're usually used to seeing images of penguins jumping maybe a few feet into the water. But this massive jump, and the fact that they went collectively and has been shown to be a thing that's been happening regularly to show that this is a ritual. This is a ritual that happens for young penguins to jump off of this cliff edge to break the ice, so to speak, with their swimming experience and really take the leap of overcoming that fear. Some of it was social pressure. You could see all the dynamics playing out. They're the first few brave penguins that are like, I'm excited about this. I'm at the forefront. I'm going to go and I'm just going to jump. And then there are others that followed behind them that started to be reluctant. They're trying to grab on the edge. They're scared. They're trying to go back into the pack, but the pack is pushing them. The pack is pushing them off the edge. And at some point they just have to go. They're flapping their wings as if they can fly and they're, you know, doing what they can to stop it on the way down. But then they get into the water and then they settle and they're like, oh, this is where I belong. This is the water that I swim in. And they so very calmly and comfortably are in the water and starting to swim and get that first swimming lesson. And so it goes faster and faster as people see the bravery happen and that they've survived and it's okay. Like no one's gotten hurt. And maybe there's still fear of the pain of splashing the water or of the high jump. Or maybe they haven't watched the other penguins make it safely and they don't know it's going to be okay. But either way, all of them eventually do it. And it's this beautiful, fascinating experience that is very true to the ubiquitous animal experience, including the human animal, of overcoming fear. And sometimes to make momentous leaps in consciousness and awareness in life, we have to take the big leap in order to make regular small ones. An example also being like getting on stage. You know, there's so much anxiety and fear leading up to it. And then you're on stage, you're nervous and all of that stuff. If you hold on to the fear, then it's going to be a really awful experience. It's like it's flapping your wings on the way down and you know, not enjoying the ride. But if you know what you're doing and you recognize that this is the water you swim in, and maybe you have a natural talent for it, or you have something you truly want to say, or the desire is there to do it, then you're just going to start to take to it. And there's a certain part of you that'll be like, there's something good about this and I want to keep pursuing it. And that's a powerful thing to own and to start to go towards. So I think this idea of counter arguments to the bigger picture concerns, AI and stuff like that, is taking the leap through conceptually and saying like, okay, so what if this happens? What are truly, honestly, realistically the possibilities of what might happen? AI, for example, we're seeing a lot of things unfold. We're seeing there's a lot of the fears and narratives based on the stories that have been unfolding around like the Terminator and Skynet and all of that stuff. But how do we compare that to the reality of our experience now and the things that we're trying to do going forward? Something like, first of all, helping us not overtax our brains, that AI can help us do a lot of writing that can save us a lot of time and energy. And writing questions or doing show notes or any number of things that will help us to speed along our productivity. And then you think on the big picture, it's attaching AI to robots and the ability to go forward without putting human lives at risk, right? So the big argument, one of the big arguments is like, it's going to take our jobs and it's going to kill us. And the taking jobs part is, you know, an understandable concern. But also there are plenty of jobs that need to be taken, you know, not putting human lives at risk. Something like going to Mars doesn't necessarily have to involve human minds. You know, we've already sent robots that don't have AI going on in them and don't have multifunctionality. They don't have ways of they don't have ways of functioning like a human can, or specialty functions. So imagine now being able to send AI robots and proxies to Mars and start to terraform it and prepare it for humans to eventually go and settle and create a new expansion, a new migration of sorts. Which, you know, if we keep going down the rabbit hole, there's obviously going to be more problems. But with every problem, there's opportunity for new direction and new expansion and new ideas. We call it progress, but it really is expansion. It's not necessarily that, you know, life needs to go in a specific direction. And I think we often get attached to that. Progress means this, when really, I think progress is about just not entropy. You know, that idea of heat death, it happens when there's entropy. There's nothing else to collide with, to create with, to expand, to do new things. And even then, when something dies, it's about making space for new things. So that's still a contribution to existence. And so it's all fluid, it's all a part of it all. When I think about the climate, for example, also, you know, I think of the meme in my head that it's like, well, will the earth be okay? I think the earth will be fine. I don't know about you guys. And that's going to be up to us. It's going to be up to us remembering as human beings that we are a migratory species. We, one of the things that's unique about us is the ability to endure in terms of walking long distances, the way that we're physically built. And as the earth has changed over the course of our existence as human beings, we migrate. We migrate with the seasons, we migrate with the change in climate. And, you know, regardless of whether or not we have impacted the change in climate, we can feel that things are changing, and that's just going to mean shifts. And so I don't think it's any surprise that shifts are happening. There's wars, there's tsunamis, hurricanes, volcanoes, earthquakes, there's rumblings. Things are happening, things are changing. And I think what happens for us, one of the things I love and I'm fascinated by when it comes to generational theory is this idea of 80-year cycles of our life. And I think we can get so caught up in the way things are that we almost don't think the way that the world is right now is going to ever change. And I think we have an investment in the world not changing, the human world not changing, the way that our lives are it not changing. You know, you look back at history and there's all sorts of different styles, the ways that houses were built, the cultures, the emblems, the totems, rituals, traditions have changed. And you know, people have migrated, they've discovered new things, they've discovered new elements, new technologies, new ideas, new philosophies, new ways of being that have created movement. Because I think if we can help it, there's something about us as human beings that we can get ourselves to be very comfortable. We can get very used to the way things are and maybe not realize that that's creating an entropy. And there's a lot of people that have, based on fear again, a desire for things to not change. And I'm not just talking about like conservatives ideologically, but all of us. You know, some of us don't want things to get better because then what would we have to complain about? That might be the thing that we don't want to change. That might be what's not enabling us to actually think about the next optimistic idea about how the world could be in a place of just needing to move, right? And with that, movement means collisions. It means like literally wars, ideological collisions, physical and conceptual, and people needing to move, leave. And that's going to come with collateral damage, which is sad and awful and has a certain devastation to it. And on the other side comes possibility, comes new creation, new growth, new ideas, new ways that we get over ourselves and start a new era. And so what's really hard to think about is like getting past that, because without the nuances of awareness of the systems and people moving, it's really easy to get caught up again in the fantasies that are also based on limitations of awareness. Zombie apocalypse, or, you know, the sky is going to rain blood and everyone's going to explode all at once. Like, I don't know, these big ideas of like climate change, meaning that the world is just going to be a big ball of fire. And, you know, there's runaway gas effects and all of that stuff, but we are a very reactive species because of that piece. And there will be a point where, like, we will actually do something when it's a survival-based fear. Conceptual fears are easy to just, like, almost attach to. There's a certain feeling of safety to have fear. Like, you know where the boundary is. There's fear because there's stuff on the other side of that boundary that keeps you within your boundary. There's something about fear that makes us feel safe. And that's the paradox of fear and safety. Bravery comes from having the fear and going forward anyway. You know, going past the boundary, thinking about new things, and going into the unknown. And in some ways, being willing to let go of some of the fear. And really tuning into what is actually worth being fearful about, right? Again, it's like these conceptual fears. It's this idea of, like, you know, believing that someone else is going to attack you because of X, Y, and Z. Most of the time, a lot of wars are this idea of ideologies. Just, I believe these things, you believe these things, irreconcilable differences. Don't touch my stuff. I won't touch your stuff. Like, and if it happens, then we explode, you know? And, you know, there are very real fears around all of that, you know, nuclear war, physical skirmishes, civil war in the U.S. and all of that stuff. I do very much believe that when it comes to human survival, there's an instinct deeper down beyond our conscious awareness that will make better decisions than we can. Both in the higher self sense of, like, we don't really want to end all of this. And then in the other side of it, where there's that instinctual awareness of almost like the body doesn't really want to self-destruct. There's the stories of people who have jumped off of a bridge and who have survived that have reported that, I think it was like 85% of the people basically said that halfway down they regretted it. There's one thing to have the fear in your mind, the self-seriousness of wanting to end your life or, you know, punish others or punish yourself that results in these extreme actions that, This kind of self-punishment and punishing of others is not sustainable to the human experience. And if we get to the point where we are going to... Oh, someone's yelling in my hallway. Hold on. Someone's pissed, apparently. There's people that live in my building that they just like talk as loud as possible in the hallways. Like no one else. There's no sense of anyone else. It's fun. It's fun to listen to from a human development standpoint. Oh, they're coming through again. What was I saying? I was talking about fear and that, yes, there's this mechanism that kicks in. There's so much conceptual fear that like I almost feel like there's this desire to kick into this like literal fear. That when we experience literal fear, it's like, oh, we know the difference. It's one thing to be a young man with a fantasy of going to war, and another thing to be in the war and see death and destruction happening around you. And then you come through that and you're like, I never want to experience that again. Or that wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And I think many of us have that disconnection. You know, we have these idealisms and imaginations, and we kind of confuse our imaginations with our patterning. You know, patterning is metaphor, it's analogy, it's comparing literal experiences. Imagination is not, it's real, but it's not yet manifest. And I think we confuse often our imagination for what is not yet manifest. So we have this imagination that the world's going to end. We have this belief that the world's going to end. We have these feelings that these people have these intentions. Or we have this philosophy that this is how the world works. But until we put those things into practice and we experience other human beings and see it all play out, we don't really know. And so for me, that brings a lot of optimism in the sense that I don't actually trust a lot of the zeitgeist's decisions of what the outcomes are going to be. Humans have survived big things in the past. We'll survive big things again. It's no guarantee, so I don't want to be naive. However, there are a lot of amazing things emerging in the world. There's increased consciousness, conscious awareness. You know, never in history to this degree have we had a sense of public awareness that people should be more sensitive to each other, kinder to each other. We're trying to put intention to parenting, for better or worse, but at least there's the intention there. And approaching traumas and trying to understand our inner world and thinking about the earth and taking care of our environment and our ecology and creating relationships to the past and second guessing all of the chemicals we've put in all of our food. And, you know, the pharmaceuticals and drugs and advertising and how it affects the brain, that kind of stuff. Like, there's a lot of considerations about that stuff. And that's to me, I think that's progress in the sense of keeping it all going. As if we stay at a certain course, it just kind of fizzles out. There's no progress. And I have a personal belief, this is more of an esoteric idea, but it's this personal belief that the universe is essentially striving for creation. And we have a hard time believing that because we don't see life yet manifest in other places. But life forming was not necessarily a spontaneous thing. There was a series of events that led to it. And all of this collision and colliding and building and emergence eventually led to all of that, what we're experiencing now. Another example of something like that would be just like what you're listening to this on. There are this, like, the memes of like, all of this is now in your pocket. And it's like a boombox and a TV and a audio recorder and a Walkman and a Betamax, you know, and a VCR and headphones. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, everything kind of coming together is a very natural process. We do it as humans, and I think there's a corollary to the universe bringing stuff together to let life emerge, which is more of a, it's complex, but ultimately a way for expansion and creation to continue to happen without more explosions and crashing and all of that stuff needing to happen. That with eventual understandings of of our awareness of the universe or AI being able to like terraform planets and stuff, we can have a greater sense of eventually, if this all continues to play out in humanity or other species, that equates to the intelligence of humanity or greater, is able to then take the principles of the universe and apply it to creating more worlds and creating solar systems and creating, you know, manufacturing the ability for more life to form. You know, it is a very real possibility that of all the trillions of suns out there, stars and subsequent planets, that, you know, maybe none of them have life on them. I think it's very likely that they do. Maybe not to the level of humans, or maybe they have and then they faltered. You know, there's like this fits and starts nature to existence. And ultimately there is like not a progress in the sense that there's an ultimate goal. Some people see that as maybe like a heat death or like an end to the universe. When, in my perception, it feels like cycles. It's life and death. It's extinctions and dynamic shifts. You know, it's this exists and then it doesn't exist, but that gives birth to a new idea that exists and then that doesn't exist. That gives birth to a new idea that exists and then doesn't exist. You know, I mean, maybe the universe is one of many universes, all of that stuff. I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to know. But I think there's what's ultimately coming to in my mind is this idea of linear thinking versus cyclical thinking. That if we're in the experience we're in and we're in linear thinking, everything is progressing towards an endpoint. That we're going to stay in this sort of free fall for thousands of years, and the earth is going to decline, and we're going to continue suffering, and it's just going to go down, 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 down. But, you know, if we think pre-World War II, it feels like a very different world. We can't imagine wearing the things that they were wearing. We can't imagine being into the things they were into, or speaking the way that they were speaking, or caring about the things that they were caring about, or even behaving the way that they were behaving. Things change, they cycle, they grow, they expand, they shift in and out. And I think it's really hard for us to imagine this world not existing, this version of us not existing. Because in those transition points are different versions of humanity that are the transition points that are part of, you can probably hear the trash in the background. Let me stop for a second, see if it picks up. I don't think it does. It's a little faint, but that's okay. Linear thinking versus cyclical thinking. You know, there are transition generations, essentially. I think everyone alive today, I suspect, is going through a transition phase. We are towards the end of a cycle, and therefore there's a lot of panic about the end. You know, the end of this. Maybe it's like gathering our materials. What are the books that we want to take into the future? What are the games? What are the movies and stuff like that? What is this era of history going to be known for in terms of its entertainment, in terms of its behavior, in terms of its contribution to the human organism, you know, versus like the late 1800s and early 1900s versus 17 to 1800s versus 16 to 1700s. Like, those eras have different themes, different ideas, different concepts that came through that we've built upon that have added to today, or things that we haven't yet reconciled that have sort of snuck through. You know, what's going to sneak through unresolved? But then what is going to transform and evolve and change? And I think part of trying to be more optimistic is seeing what are the positives that are going to come through. Because when we're dealing with survival. When we're in a situation where things are getting dire, where money is a challenge, where there's increased need for movement. We have to get out of entropy, and there's new lines being drawn, new ideological lines, new physical lines, having to move away from locations because of weather pattern changes, maybe new laws being put into place that are making people move, or work opportunities, or even just like wanting to make a lifestyle change, or you're thinking a different way, or wanting to be around different people, or whatever. It just seems like a lot is happening at once, and that is going to lead to this kind of era change. And so all of that movement creates new possibility, new emergence that are really hard to predict, but it just needs to happen. And in that survival of all of that comes drastic change. It comes with making decisions that are going to last for a while, that are going to be impacting the beginning of whatever the next era is going to be and look like. That includes all of those things. It's lifestyle changes, it's laws, it's physical boundaries, it's location based on ecology and the way that weather patterns are moving, and new laws being put into place to welcome people or to move people out of certain spaces, or creating new environments that maybe change how apartment complexes work, or how the economy is structured, how new opportunities unfold. You know, there's all sorts of ways in which new laws, new technologies that are, again, enabled by this survival need. You know, let's take, for example, at its worst, if there is an attack on the East Coast of the United States, that now much of like shipping and stuff needs to come from the West Coast. And there have been talks for a long time of having to do bullet trains and speed trains. And with the Civil War, what changed the game was building the railroads, and that ended up moving the energy along and created speed of transfer of goods. And right now, a lot of the challenges with, frankly, survival is all based on location. It's all based on location and resources. So trade, stuff like that. And so creating new technologies that enable trade to be moved along, and something like a bullet train would speed things along to get resources from the West Coast to the East Coast, which would be in the wake of something as devastating as, let's say, like an attack on New York City, that would be the equivalent of the attack on London in World War II. But from the emergence of that would come rebuilding eventually, and creativity that comes from having to be innovative given the circumstance. Like, when things change drastically, they just change and we have to adapt to them. And I think these are always situations in which we get to finally prove how adaptable we are. Whereas over the last 10, 15, 20 years, it's almost been like this increased entropy of like, how do we make ourselves more comfortable? How do we make it more convenient to talk to each other, to be more, to be more relaxed, to work remotely, to do all these things in which, you know, we have to engage less and less with reality. Whereas if there's a lot of movement, then we're going to be put into situations in which we're needing to show that we can adapt. And so fear is often like this belief that we're not as adaptable as we think we are. And I do think that we are inherently adaptable. We're creative. We have complex minds. We have systems thinking. We have the ability to weave things together. And not only from that perspective in terms of the external world, but from the internal experience of finding gratitude through these things happening and greater connectedness through these things happening. And a sense of focus and purpose and attunement to our humanity especially when it comes to grief and large quantities of loss, which we've already been experiencing. And it may be a case that we're expecting this big moment when it may be a series of moments that we'll look back on as one big happening. But when we're in it, we're just adapting as we need to adapt and changing as we need to change. And we have a lot more resilience than I think we give ourselves credit for as individuals. And so, you know, while there are certainly situations in which we can like test our grit and test our mettle and see if our imagination matches up to reality, I think technologies will emerge that will just make things more fluid and able to operate more smoothly and to give more of a sense of purpose to more people to focus on themselves and their work and less on each other. And so, like, to me, that's an optimistic view of a faith in humanity and a love of humanity in our adaptability. And ultimately being able to say that, like, most of the time when I meet human beings in like random places, they're kind, they're loving, they're generous. They just want to have a conversation, or they just want to share a space, or they want to share a meal. And it's when it comes back to those simple things, it's a beautiful experience. When we get in our head, when we get in our imagination, when we start to imagine the enemy that's in our pockets, things get suddenly fearful and skittish, and we don't make the best choices. But I believe that everything is progressing as it needs to. That if it wasn't now, it would be eventually, that we would have to reconcile with each other's thoughts and each other's feelings and playing out our fears and not ask what if anymore and see what happens. And as we see what happens, then we deal with the aftermath, regardless of what that is. And I do believe there's an aftermath. And with the aftermath, there's regrowth. And, you know, that's the cyclical thinking of it all. The scary part, understandably, is that we humans are not necessarily guaranteed to be part of the continued cycle. So to express the fear is not invalid. I don't want that to be assumed that I'm trying to invalidate fears by saying like, oh, we need to think more positively. That's like I'm not saying that, but I'm saying not to ignore the positive considerations that new laws, new technologies, new thought patterns, because we're going to get sick of the way that we're talking about things. I'm already sick of the way that we're talking about things. You know, we saturate. And we explore every possibility, and then a new thing just emerges. Kind of like AI itself. You know, AI is almost this emergent itself of all of the thoughts and ideas and patterns that we've put on the internet up to this point. And now AI is like, yeah, this is all of it. And, you know, if we're patterning what's coming next, you know, this is the natural next thing that's going to occur. And as that becomes saturated, as AI starts to build, you know, these realistic replacements for various art styles and stuff, then we're going to see a pattern there. And humans are just going to adapt and make a new art style. And then we're going to make a new type of music. And then we're going to do, you know, create new types of housing. And maybe something that's 3D printed. And, you know, if a city is demolished, how does that get rebuilt? And if that gets rebuilt, can it be rebuilt sustainably? Can the buildings itself generate energy now? You know, because it's easier to rebuild than it is to retrofit. There's just a lot of, there's a lot of positive possibilities that can come through disaster. And that's not to say that the disaster needs to happen. But if it is going to happen, which I think it will, somewhere, somehow, some way, and has been, that we're adaptable and we will take our ethos that we've been discovering up to this point and we will apply it to the next era of existence. So I don't know if this episode really captured what I wanted to capture, but I mostly wanted to get the idea out around fear being a main driver and how fear can really block and limit our thinking. And it's really thinking beyond fear. It's not excluding the fear. It's tuning the fear. It's actually because it's accurate and valid to be fearful in a literal way. If someone's walking towards you with a bat, it's valid to be fearful. If you're imagining someone walking towards you with a bat, I don't think it's as valid to be fearful. It's like waking up dreaming that your partner cheated on you. It's not an omen that they're going to cheat on you. It just means you're insecure. And there's something else that needs to be addressed. You know, it's like attuning to what the accuracy of what these messages are saying. And then from there, imagining a better outcome, not just using our imagination for worry, but how can we imagine a better way? How can we imagine sustainable homes and sustainable cars and not even just like in an ideological way, but like what ways are practical, you know, because I live in an apartment building. I can't plug in a car, you know, that's not realistic, you know? So is it hybrids? Is it, taking advantage of the land? Is like, what are the actual practical solutions? And I think when push comes to shove and we have to face the reality of it and we get an opportunity to build the next thing, I think we're going to actually test these things and be able to see what works and implement them. And that's, to me, is like, that's exciting despite what that's going to cost. So it's a give and take, as with anything. You know, we drive cars, and cars are the cause of many deaths, accidents every single day. But the trade-off is that we can get places much, much faster than if we were walking. And if there's anything about human beings, it's usually about getting places faster and doing things more efficiently. And to me, I think that's going to be a big part of our future. So I could keep going, but I should probably wrap this up. Dopamine.substack.com, DOPEAMINE, like, yo, that's dope. Check that out. There is more premium recordings that I'm starting to do. I have different sections now. One is called Personality Strategy. That is about the depth of personality type, especially when it comes to developmental psychology, diving into things like shadow functions and some of the depth material there. And then The Spiral is a section all about the stages model, spiral dynamics, more about developmental psychology, but it's using those sort of specific frameworks and maybe sometimes referencing external world happenings. There's also The Mood, which is more mental health specific, and other sections that I'm forgetting. So go check it out. Dopamine.substack.com, DOPEAMINE. That's it for this episode. I just wanted to get some thoughts out. I appreciate you listening. Take care of yourselves and each other. My name is Christian Rivera, and I'll catch you next time on Dopamine. See ya.